All right, everyone, we will go ahead and begin, and I want to welcome you to this Twitter space. My name is Andrew Walker, and I serve as a fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center, as well as a professor of Christian Ethics at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and I'm joined here by several friends who will be talking with us about the implications and details of today's incredibly significant ruling and the overturning of Roe and Casey. And to have that conversation, I'm joined with Ryan Anderson, who is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, as well as Alexandria DeSanctis Marr, who is a fellow with EPPC and also a writer for National Review. Also, Ed Whalen, who is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and Sharif Gurgis, who is an associate professor of law at Notre Dame Law School. And we should have potentially a few others join us as well. One programming note to Mary Hassan, you should have gotten a link to join as a speaker. So Mary, if you can join us, we would love to have you on the line as well. So I want to kick things off to Ryan and Ed, and I would love for you all to set today's decision in the context of its historical significance. As a non-lawyer myself, this strikes me as one of the most important days in American history, but I would love to hear from Ed and Ryan on that to start things off this afternoon.
Sure.
And one last thing I'll also add, this is on the record for any journalists who are listening. Feel free to quote. And I'm also recording this space as well, and will do my best to make it available as soon as we end this afternoon. So, Ed, if you would go ahead and begin your remarks.
Sure. In order to understand the significance of today's ruling, you need to have in mind how outrageous the Roe versus Wade ruling was in 1973, a radical ruling inventing a constitutional right to abortion that overrode the laws of all 50 states on a matter that the Constitution, I think, clearly leaves to the democratic processes. Roe has corrupted American politics and culture ever since then. When I was a law clerk for Justice Scalia 30 years ago, the court had a golden opportunity to fix this error. Instead, it compounded it in Planned Parenthood versus Casey with grandiose statements basically asserting that the court is at the vanguard of our society and we are all just supposed to follow it and you know, end our moral and policy debates over this critical issue. So what we see today is a crowning achievement of the conservative legal movement, which continued to fight against Roe, a great achievement of the pro-life movement, which never gave up. What we have here is a ruling that overturns Roe and Casey, restores the matter to the democratic processes, where we're going to have big battles ahead of us, battles to assure justice, not only for the lives of the unborn human beings, but also for the vulnerable mothers. It's just the beginning of a new era in this battle.
Ryan, on to you. Give us your take on the historical significance of this day.
I think it's hard to overstate the historical significance. I mean, this is something that Americans have been working on for 49 years, for the most part peacefully, working through the process, explaining why Roe and Casey were wrong, getting the right judges appointed and confirmed, making the case for life both as a constitutional matter, as a moral matter, and as a cultural matter. I think this will be a day that we will look back on as reversing one of the great injustices of American history. Any time throughout human history, we have rendered a class of human beings as non-persons, you know, denied the personhood of a class of human beings, we have looked back on horror. It's true with the Holocaust. It's true with slavery. And one day that's how we will view abortion. And so the first step of getting us there is admitting we made a mistake with Roe and Casey. Today's decision will be praised precisely for that. But in terms of the historical significance, this isn't the end, right? This is just the beginning. To a certain extent, history doesn't shape itself. We're not Hegelians, and the work is, you know, up to us to see that our laws now reflect the moral truth, that man-made law reflects the natural law, and that we protect unborn children and their mothers from the violence of abortion.
Excellent. Thanks, Ryan. We also have Carter Sneed with us, who is also a professor of law at University of Notre Dame, as well as a fellow with the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And Carter, I want to pitch this question to you as well, is the historical significance of this day, of this ruling. So, I mean, you've studied this. You're a leading bioethicist, particularly around the law on these topics. Give us your take on historical significance.
Thanks very much. And it's a pleasure to join all of you. It is an extraordinary moment historically. And obviously, I mean, if you want to abstract from the context, which of course none of us want to do, it's refreshing to see how the Supreme Court, after decades of hearing, of sustaining an opinion that is not connected to the text, history, or tradition of the Constitution, and also it was essentially a conclusion in search of a rationale for 50 years of shifting norms and standards and rules and guidelines. It was never on stable footing as a matter of precedent. And so the principles of stare decisis fairly applied, as Justice Alito's opinion and Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion do, show that this is something that the court actually is in the business of correcting historic and grievous mistakes. And I think that's important to reaffirm. As for the mistake that they're correcting, it was an extraordinary mistake. I mean, the court basically invented out of whole cloth a right to abortion, as I say, with no connection at all to the text, history, or tradition of the Constitution. And for 50 years, they were trying to backfill and explain why that was a good decision, when in fact it was just a naked policy preference, a balancing of competing interests and goods, reproductive autonomy on the one hand, which of course is important, but also the intrinsic equal dignity of every human life, including prenatal human beings on the other. And they tried to dress up what was a policy analysis and as a constitutional opinion. And it's easy to lose track of the fact when you read those precedents that, in fact, what they're supposed to be doing is interpreting the 14th Amendment and not simply settling on what they think is the best policy or legal approach for this vexed question. So I'm incredibly encouraged. And I think we have to say right now that it's unbelievable the courage that it required for the justices to do this, not just in terms of the threats to their very lives, which we saw unfold since the sort of breathtaking, norm-breaking leak of the draft opinion earlier in May, but to be true to their role as justices, to actually be true to their role as interpreting the Constitution, not making law, not imposing their will on others under a specious interpretation or even a dressed-up interpretation, as I said. And I think it's impressive and it's reassuring that the justices in doing this. And the amazing thing is, what they're doing is actually reducing their own power in this opinion. They're letting the people decide these questions. They're releasing their authority, which they asserted in 1973, which also is encouraging. It's always an encouraging thing when a government official gives power back to the people. And the criticism of this being anti-democratic or contrary to the will of the people, I find puzzling, because it's precisely the opposite. It is returning to the American people the authority that everyone around the world, except for in the United States, has, which is to govern themselves on the question of abortion rather than submit to the will of unelected justices.
Great. Thanks, Carter. Alexandria, I want to go to you. So you're with me as kind of a younger millennial kind of activist and intellectual on these topics. What's going through your mind on a day like today? I mean, personally, I've never felt like this day would arrive. How are you responding to this?
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. And, you know, honestly, I've been part of the pro-life movement for a microcosm compared to most of the people on this call and so many people in the pro-life movement. But I would just say, yeah, I feel kind of astonished. It's almost hard to believe that it's actually happening. I don't think it's sunk in, even though I think many of us have seen this coming almost for a year, right? It was clear that there was a majority we hoped and thought was against Roe, realized that Roe and Casey were just anti-constitutional nonsense. It's just kind of hard to believe that it actually might happen. And even in my kind of short time of following this sort of thing, I've gotten used to being disappointed by the court and thinking something good would happen and it just wouldn't turn out that way. And so I was kind of bracing myself pessimistically for a while, even though, you know, it seemed like a real possibility that Roe might be overturned. So I definitely am very pleased to be alive for this day and to be a small part of the movement, and very grateful to everybody who fought to make this happen, right? Especially those, you know, there's countless pro-lifers all across the country who've been fighting this battle, whose names many of us, most of us will never know, and who won't be remembered by many, but who really got us to this day. So I'm very, very grateful to all of them.
Thanks, Alexandra. Appreciate that. I want to turn to the opinion itself. And I want to have everyone who's a speaker kind of take 30 seconds and give us their reaction to the actual opinion as far as the substance and the jurisprudence, which I know 30 seconds might be difficult. But I want to begin with Sharif. You're in the same boat as Alexandra and I, younger millennial. What is your response to the opinion itself upon reading it? I'm sure you're probably maybe still reading it for that matter.
I'm glad to be called young. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's the most striking thing about it immediately is that it's almost exactly the same as the released opinion, which is extraordinary because both the incentives and the opportunities to fly spec and critique and find objective errors have never been stronger. It's the abortion issue, which is, you know, the most heated issue in our national politics. The draft was leaked, which has never happened before, which meant that people could have thought they had a chance to get the majority to change the reasoning or to get to feed the dissents good ideas. And it was chock full of very dense and confident historical claims, including claims that prove a vast negative, like there has never been a state or federal case or statute or even a legal treatise or an academic article until right before Roe that ever suggested there was such a right. And despite all the opportunities to critique it, none of the critiques landed. You can object to the legal reasoning on the familiar grounds, but in terms of objective historical or other errors, it remains completely intact because nobody identified any.
Great, thanks. Mary, if we can turn to you, just your reaction to the actual opinion itself.
Sure. You know, I'm struck by its clarity. I'm struck by its forcefulness in a sense that it does not shrink away from identifying what has been a problem in our national conversation of not really being able to talk about what's at stake. And so the opinion calls out the dissent specifically, saying for failing to acknowledge the interests of the unborn human being. And again, the court says it's not deciding those interests, but is acknowledging this is really part of the discussion. So I was struck by the court's willingness to do that, to frame the issue, because that is the issue that's going to be grappled with back at the states. I was also struck by the decision's impact on women in this sense, that for too long the narrative has been that women believe one thing about abortion, that women want only one solution. And the court was very clear in talking about how by returning abortion to the legislatures, this allows women who are on both sides of the issue to really work to bring our opinions to bear in those states with legislators, et cetera. And so I thought that was a really important acknowledgement that there is no monolithic women's position, and certainly not one that rhymes with the Roe Casey line of thinking. So I really appreciated both of those and found that very significant.
Great. Thanks, Mary. We are joined by Professor Robert George, who is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton University, one of our nation's most foremost public intellectuals on these topics. Professor George, you just joined us, but the question is kind of reactions to the opinion itself, and would love to get your opinion and perspective on what you're reading and understanding about the actual opinion. Let me see if I can unmute Professor George, perhaps.
Okay.
There we are. Dr. George, go ahead.
Very good. The opinion, as far as I've been able to tell on a skim, and I haven't had a chance to read the opinion and concurrences and dissents very carefully yet, but it looks like it's very much in line with the draft that we saw, unfortunately, as a result of a leak some time back. And that's interesting because once that draft opinion was out, critics had an opportunity to go over it with a fine-tooth comb, to find faults and errors and flaws, which they could then criticize publicly, of course. And there was plenty of public criticism, but it wasn't any good. And it turns out that there was not a lot of need on Justice Alito's part to make significant changes. Now, again, I'm saying that on the basis of a skim, and I need to read it more carefully before I can say that with complete confidence. But that really jumped out at me, Andrew.
Great, thank you. Ryan, your reaction to the opinion?
You know, I think it's exactly what the state of Mississippi had asked for, which was to overturn Roe and Casey. And I think now it sets up another line of legal argument, which would be 14th Amendment personhood, whether that's being done through judicial review or through legislation. I mean, I think the ultimate goal here, overturning Roe and Casey isn't, you know, the end point. And so I don't think anyone should think that this is, you know, all we would ever ask on the abortion issue is overturning Roe and Casey. And so, but I also don't think it's a criticism of the court. I don't think this particular case, this particular vehicle was the right way to approach those questions. So I think it leaves those questions for another day. You know, Robbie's very humble. He and John Finnis filed a very persuasive amicus brief in this case, making the point for 14th Amendment personhood and the common law standard of, you know, abortion was prohibited under the common law. It was prohibited in all the states at the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment. It's clear that they relied on that second part, the common law part, in this ruling. But I think now we need to push forward an argument to make sure that every child is protected all throughout the United States.
Great. Thanks. Alexandra?
Yeah, you know, I certainly haven't had time to digest the entire thing in full. It'll take me quite a while to get through it at that level. But I would say my first reaction is just how thoroughly Justice Alito debunks every argument we've ever heard in favor of Roe and Casey, right? He goes through in great detail. And the one that stands out to me in particular is, you know, the point that history and tradition do not, there's no reason to believe that there's a right to abortion in the Constitution. And I think, you know, like Ryan said, there's definitely a roadmap to the future we have to keep pushing for. This is not the end of the debate by any means. But I think it's just a very forceful renunciation of the idea that Roe was ever a good idea, that it was ever based in the Constitution or anything in the American tradition. And I think it's really important to have debunked that notion, because that's the main argument we hear from abortion supporters, right, is that this is somehow actually a constitutional right. And the court has now, you know, violated its duty by doing this. But the argument is right there. And it's very compelling that was never the case.
Great. Thank you. Let's go to Ed and then to Carter as well.
I think Justice Alito's majority opinion is masterful, and it's a triumph of the conservative legal movement. Putting things in broader context, recall that back in 2005, conservatives revolted when President George W. Bush nominated his White House counsel, Harriet Myers, to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. They said, no, we want someone with the intellectual heft. We want someone who can be a leader. Although it wasn't put in exactly in these terms, we said we want someone who could write a forceful opinion overturning Roe. And of course, we ended up, thank God, with Samuel Alito filling that seat.
Great. Carter?
Yeah, I agree with everything everyone has said. One small point. I think there's a really interesting and important point in Justice Kavanaugh's concurring opinion, in case people were worried that he was going to, in his concurring opinion, take away the great reasoning or take away from the great reasoning of Justice Alito's opinion. I think it's not the case. He has one sentence on page 11 of his concurring opinion that says, this court will never again balance the competing interests of the pregnant woman and the unborn human child. So any questions that were rolled out by hostile commentators after the draft was leaked about whether or not.
Great, thank you. Let's go ahead and turn to another question. And I want to go first with Sharif and then to Carter and to Ed. Help explain to us kind of the central holding of this opinion, as far as what does today's opinion do to undo Roe from a legal technicality perspective?
Sure. So it restores what's called rational basis review to any abortion regulation. That means that these are presumed to be constitutional, and it's going to be any given abortion regulation or ban will be constitutional as long as the legislator could have thought, doesn't matter what was actually in their heads, just whether they could have thought that the regulation would serve a legitimate interest. And then the opinion specifies what count as legitimate interests. And the first one is respect for and preservation of prenatal life at all stages of development. So not development, including from before implantation. That basically covers every reasonable regulation, every abortion regulation I'm aware of that exists or has been proposed anytime in the recent past.
Great. Carter and then Ed. Carter or Ed, are you available?
I think Carter switched to listener mode. Ed is on.
I'm here. Look, Sharif captured the essential point about what the new standard of review is going forward. The opinion also sets forth an elaborate analysis of stare decisis factors. When should the court adhere to precedent? When should it not? There's nothing groundbreaking there, but it's a very comprehensive account of the factors that bear on the analysis, especially when you have constitutional error. So I think the dissenters pretend that that precedent is much more sacrosanct, but no justice has ever taken that view. So I think it would be a compelling opinion, both for what it says about the standard going forward, but also on the stare decisis analysis. On the stare decisis analysis, I would add that although the Chief Justice did not join the opinion, when you read his separate opinion, there's every reason to think that he will be a sixth vote to give stare decisis effect to the Dobbs ruling itself.
That's really compelling. Let's turn to the concurrences and the dissents. And of course, I'm assuming in asking this that you all have had at least a little bit of time to look over them. So to any of our speakers who've had a chance to look at the concurrences or dissents, what stands out about those that we should be paying attention to?
Ed Whalen here. Let me emphasize that it's important to distinguish between concurrences and concurrences in the judgment. So someone who simply concurs is saying, I agree with everything in the opinion, and maybe I just have some further thoughts to add. So there are two concurrences, one by Justice Thomas, who explained why he thought the whole oxymoron of substantive due process should be interred. And then there's one by Justice Kavanaugh, who spelled out his own views, reinforcing what the majority had to say on the wrongness of Roe and on stare decisis. He also added some comments about how he might view some of the issues that might reach the court in the future, including he makes clear his view that there's a right to interstate travel that would prevent criminalizing mothers traveling interstate in order to get abortions. That's not an issue that the majority reached. It's not an issue that was briefed. He's set forth his view, but that's all that is. The Chief Justice wrote an opinion concurring in the judgment. It's an interesting opinion, a problematic opinion in a lot of ways. He agrees that very forcefully that Roe and Casey were wrong in setting forth a viability line, which is at the heart of their holding. He says, though, that the court doesn't need to overturn them in their entirety now, that it's enough to say that basically to reconsider them as saying that a woman has to have one clear chance to get an abortion, that Mississippi's 15-week law amply provides that, and that the question of full overruling of Roe and Casey should have been deferred to a later case.
Great. I want to turn to a question for Professor George. In addition to being an EPPC board member, he also runs the James Madison Institute for American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton. And Professor George, I would love for you to put today's ruling in the context of it returning us back to those American ideals and what those ideals are, perhaps, and how this ruling gets us back to those.
Well, the central ideal of the American founding is the principle of the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family. That's articulated, of course, famously in the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence, which says that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, we as a nation from the very beginning failed to live up to that great principle, to our most fundamental ideals. But at our best, we have struggled as a nation to honor that great principle, those ideals, including in our Constitution. We fought a civil war. Ultimately, it was over the issue of slavery, not just secession, but what was behind secession, which was slavery. In his second inaugural address, Lincoln made that clear. It had been a point he wasn't clear on prior to that. But in that second inaugural address, he made it clear that everyone knows that behind this all, somewhere behind this all the carnage of the war was the issue of slavery. So when the war was over, when the Union was preserved, enormous costs of blood and treasure, the nation amended the Constitution to deal with the abolition of slavery in the 13th Amendment, and then in the 14th Amendment, all the different ways in which the various institutions of the state government could, and undoubtedly, as they knew, would, discriminate against the recently freed slaves and their descendants. But they framed their principles, trying to do justice to that most basic fundamental principle in broad terms, not in terms of race or any particular race, but rather in terms of the rights of persons. The 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Here again, the failure of Reconstruction, the imposition of Jim Crow segregation, meant that we went for generations failing to live up to that fundamental ideal. And that's what the great civil rights struggle, led by men like Martin Luther King, was all about. Not just men, by the way, you know, Harriet Tubman, people like that. We in the pro-life movement, for more than 49 years, our movement began prior to Roe versus Wade, when some states moved in the direction of liberalizing or legalizing abortion. Our movement has always been a movement committed to that basic principle, the principle of profound, inherent, and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family, the principle embodied in the Declaration and in the 14th Amendment, the equality and worth and dignity of all. And after Roe did such damage to that principle, undermined, set us back massively in our efforts to be a nation that was true to its founding ideals, we worked relentlessly with determination and against terrible odds. Alas, we found ourselves opposite the most powerful, influential, prestigious elements of our society. The leadership of the intellectual community went in the other direction. Journalism went in the other direction. The great philanthropies, business corporations, everyone seemed to get on board with the idea that somehow it was legitimate to exclude the unborn from the protection of the laws. But nevertheless, with all those odds stacked against us, we worked with determination. We struggled in the state legislatures. We worked not just in politics, but to bring practical care and concern to women experiencing difficult pregnancies, women in need in our pro-life clinics around the country. And we marched every year in Washington, D.C., every January, in the snow and in the cold. We marched to keep this cause alive. So our cause is very much in the tradition of the great civil rights struggles of the past. And like those struggles, its aim has been to restore us, to really bring us to the first time fully to fidelity to the principle of the inherent and equal dignity of each and every member of the human family.
That's great. Thank you, Professor George. I want to turn to Alexandra and Mary with this question. No doubt in the coming days, the language of a conservative war on women is going to be invoked by progressives. And so I would just love for you all to kind of respond to that talking point and to kind of refute it. Why is this not a war on women?
I guess I'll jump in. This is Mary. I think the first thing is what I mentioned earlier, that the court acknowledges that there isn't one women's position. And by allowing this to be addressed in the states, it's an opportunity for women to be heard, not for the court to be making a judgment. And I think as well, the court discussed the reliance issue and really reframed that in a way that I think is very healthy. Too often we're told as women that the cost of equality, the cost of participating in society is that we must be willing to let go of our pregnancies, to end our pregnancies. It really pits women against their children. And so I think this is an opportunity here to reframe that conversation, to open the door to more meaningful conversations, to find real solutions when women are facing difficult pregnancies, when they need more support, when they have to go back to work, maternity leave, family leave, you know, all of those things. I think our culture in many respects and our political machinery really has not grappled with them in the way that we need to. And so I'm hopeful that rather than allowing this to be portrayed as a war on women, I think this is opens the door for women really to be free to value not just their own life and their career, but their children, and to rightfully call upon society to say, help, you know, how are you going to help me do that? And I think that's where we're going to see the pro-life community not just do what it's always done, which really has been to provide a lot of tangible support to women in those circumstances, but I think we're going to see just an exponential growth in that. And we're already seeing that in some states. So I think this is a game changer for women. The possibilities are opened, not limited.
Great. Alexander?
Yeah, Mary has really covered it there. I'd add two quick points. The first is the idea that pro-lifers or the court in this decision would be accused of perpetrating a war on women by people who won't even say what a woman is anymore is pretty ludicrous, right? I mean, for months now, maybe even a year or so, the Planned Parenthoods and NARALs of the world have been issuing all their press materials using the phrases, you know, pregnant person or people who are pregnant. They won't even use the word women. So to now turn around and say, you know, this is a war on women is just ludicrous, right? They've totally caved to gender ideology and want to talk about women only when it's politically useful to them and getting what they want. But then second of all, I would certainly point listeners to the work of our colleague Erica Bakiaki on this question of abortion and women. And she, along with many other female scholars, filed a brief at the Supreme Court in this case, making the case that, you know, abortion is actually not a good thing for women. And their argument really has informed my thought. Her work has informed my thought. You know, the idea that abortion is pitched as this thing that women need, that's good for women, that women can't succeed without, we can't be free and equal to men without it. That's just a lie, right? Women actually don't need abortion. Women are not defective males. Society should not be organized around the idea that pregnancy, childbearing, child rearing are some kind of problem that we need to do away with so that women can function as if they were men. We have to take seriously the kind of the reality of human embodiment as male and female. And so I think this decision is a really important step towards rejecting the lie that abortion is good for women or some kind of solution to female biology.
Thanks. Ryan, I want to turn to you. And I distinctly recall when we did this Twitter space conversation on the day of the oral arguments of Dobbs, you said something very provocative that I haven't forgotten. And you said, if we get to a point in time where Roe is overturned, that doesn't signal the end of the pro-life movement. It signals the beginning of the pro-life movement in a new way. Can you unpack that? I think those listening could stand to hear what you meant by that.
Sure. Overturning Roe and Casey was a necessary precondition of then doing the work that needs to be done. And the work that needs to be done, much of it has already been going on because, you know, we had to overturn Roe and Casey to do the legal side of the pro-life cause. The cultural side, the social side, we've already been doing for over 50 years. And so I think now what we need to do is realize that there's a series of both ands. Like, we need all of the above. We need everything. Meaning that we need to be operating both in the legal spheres and the cultural spheres. When people say, oh, should the pro-life movement focus on the law or focus on the culture? It's not an either or, it's a both and. It's gonna be a state-based and a federal-based strategy, right? And some of the most immediate wins are gonna happen at the state level. Things like the Texas Heartbeat Bill and things like the Texas Alternatives to Abortion Program, right? So we need to be doing passing state legislation where and when we can in the states that are going to be open to this, while also working to limit the damage in the blue states that are going to be protecting lethal violence in the womb, unfortunately, and also advancing a federal strategy. Because, you know, a house divided cannot stand. We can't be half pro-abortion, half pro-life. The ultimate objective here has to be protecting all babies in the womb, all mothers carrying unborn children throughout all 50 states. So we need to function in the states and at the federal level. We need to address both the supply for abortion, right? The abortionists, the people killing the babies, and the demand for abortion. You know, what are the underlying reasons why women think they need abortion? And we need to address those reasons, right? Many of that's being done heroically by pregnancy resource centers, which is why it's just utterly outrageous that those centers are being targeted by, to my mind, domestic terrorist groups, you know, firebombing pregnancy resource centers, vandalizing them. These groups exist simply to empower women who choose life. And so it really puts the lie to the claim that the other side is pro-choice, because it's very clear that they don't want to support that choice. We need to continue doing that at the cultural level. We also need to be doing things like the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. They funded $100 million this past year, allocated $100 million to that program to provide women with real choices, real alternatives. Just 2 weeks ago, Senator Romney introduced a family policy plan, which to my mind, it's the best one that's been introduced so far. It's a providential moment that the overturning of Roe and Casey is happening at the very same time that many Republican elected officials are thinking seriously about economic policy to support families and to support mothers carrying babies. So all of that to say is that there's so much work to be done by everyone. Everyone on this call has a role to play. And some of it's going to be legal. Some of it's going to be cultural. Some of it's going to be family policy. Some of it's going to be abortion policy. And then I think all of us, especially for those of us who are believers, there's a spiritual component to this, and prayer needs to be essential to this, including something as simple as praying for peace tonight. We've seen the pro-abortion left threaten violence on the night of a decision overturning Roe and Casey. And so there's a spiritual component to this, and there's something that all of us can contribute.
Great. Thanks, Ryan. I want to turn this slightly back to a policy discussion. And you mentioned this, Ryan, how this is going to become a federal and state level policy debate to some extent. And we've been reading in the New York Times even last week about the extent to which the Biden administration is wanting to use every disposal at its power to continue abortion as much as possible, even in red states, using the powers that they have. What should we expect from the Biden administration in the future regarding their continued efforts to ensconce abortion in our nation's laws?
Sorry, Andrew is
Carter, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think we can expect a forceful response. I think they've already been talking about what they're going to do. Elizabeth Warren sent a letter to the president making some recommendations. I think the first thing they're going to, I mean, Biden even talked about declaring a state of emergency, which would symbolically kind of shocking the idea that the American people can decide for themselves the law and policy of abortion as a state of emergency. But put that to the side, one of the main functions of that was to allow practitioners, medical practitioners, to practice medicine across state lines, which is an authority that has always been reposed in the states to regulate the practice of medicine, to allow doctors, to license doctors, to certify doctors. You can't practice medicine across state lines except in very extenuating circumstances. I think that there's going to be action from the Food and Drug Administration. They might very well move to try to make abortion pills more accessible. They might try to assert their authority to preempt state laws on abortion. I think we could even see the possibility of someone trying to carve out abortion enclaves and federal property on state lands in states in which abortion is otherwise restricted. You could imagine Indian reservations, federal prisons, military bases becoming the sites of abortion clinics. We have big questions about, I mean, now all of these things, I think there are good and strong legal responses to, and what they signal is that we're gonna have a legal struggle alongside the important struggle to care for moms and babies and families that Ryan just so articulately expressed. This is not just the beginning of a new moment to care for mothers and babies and families, which of course it is. this is also the beginning of a new phase of battle in the court, in the courts, and in the political sphere to try to prevent the government, the federal government, from overreaching to impose itself into those states that seek to protect unborn human life.
Thanks, Carter. Sharif, I want to turn to you next, and I just want to kind of ask you, what are the legal arguments moving forward in the pro-life movement to further protect life? I mean, I think we're all on the same page that overturning Roe doesn't end the legal debate for us. It simply opens up new avenues for us to fight. And so what are those avenues? What are those laws we should be trying to advocate for?
Sure. So one thing, just picking up at the end of the last question you asked me, is that there will be a question about exactly what the meets and bounds of this decision are. I think it's clear that the decision depends on the idea that the statutes as of 1868 in Appendix A are constitutional. And from 1828 down to 1960, the states increasingly banned abortion in all stages, with just one exception, which was for the mother's life or sometimes life or serious bodily injury. So the opinion depends on the idea that those are constitutional. So what are sometimes called non-elective abortions that don't have to do with life. So health in a very broad sense to mean psychological and financial and familial health, or other exceptions. Those are not constitutionally required. So that's one point. The next thing that will come up is a lot of the ancillary issues that Carter and others have mentioned. So whether states can ban the facilitation of abortions, even if the abortions end up happening out of state. I think if a law is phrased in that way, if it's general, if it's not targeting travel as such, but just any facilitation, even if the abortion itself happens later, there might be a case for its constitutionality. There will be questions about whether you can ban the shipment of abortion drugs into the state. And there's actually a federal law, the Comstock Act of 1873, which bans the shipment of abortion drugs by mail. States, that obviously hasn't been enforced. States will begin to look at that. There'll be challenges based on whether the FDA's approval of these drugs preempts or overrides state regulations of them. I think the likely answer to that is no, but that will be a field of debate. There will be questions about whether Congress can require a prohibition of abortion or prohibit abortion itself across the board, and there will be strong arguments under current doctrine that that is permissible. And so both sides are going to take to Congress in an attempt to nationalize abortion policy.
Great. Thanks, Sharif. Professor George, I want to come back to you as far as kind of how we engage civically on this topic as citizens. I'm looking at a tweet of yours from just over an hour ago. You say, "Let us not exult over those of our fellow citizens, good people who are sincerely concerned about women's welfare, who see the demise of Roe as a disaster. Malice towards none, charity for all." You go on to write, "Let us today highly resolve to build a nation that honors the profound, inherent, and equal dignity of all, a nation that cares for all its children at every stage and for mothers and families. We will never be perfect, but we can be better, and we can all work together." Can you just give us some advice and instruction on how we should be proceeding with this conversation as American citizens and with our neighbors, with family members, for that matter?
Yes, Andrew. Of course, I'm quoting Lincoln in both of those tweets. And the first one actually began citing Lincoln explicitly. I said, "I'd like all pro-lifers today, please read Lincoln's second inaugural address. It's very short. It will take you 4 minutes or less. But I think all of us should take a moment, take those 4 minutes, and read it. Because the spirit in which Lincoln addresses the country, North and South, in that address is the spirit that we need to have informing our discussions with our fellow citizens today. This is a day of joy, no question about that, especially for people who've worked for all these years. It's also a day of sadness because we remember the lives that have been lost, the carnage of Roe versus Wade, just as Lincoln looked back on the carnage of the war from his perspective on March 5th, 1865, when he was taking the oath for the second time. But it's not a time to be exulting over our enemies. We're going to feel the temptation. It's natural. It's human to do that. We beat you guys. We beat you elites. You thought you carried the future with you. You believe in the inevitability of liberal progress, woke ideology. But we need to resist the temptation to exult over those on the other side. And we need to remember that most of those people are good people. They've gotten themselves on the wrong side of a terribly, terribly, terribly important issue. They've gotten themselves on the wrong side of that fundamental principle of the profound, equal, and inherent dignity of each and every member of the human family. But that does not mean they're monsters, and it doesn't mean that they're bad people. And we need to work with them to find ways to accomplish what we and they want. When I listen to Marion, when I listen to Alexandra, I want to say amen, exactly. When I read Erica Bakayoki's writing, yes, we all believe, we as much as the people on the other side believe we need to protect the welfare, the interests of women. But as Alexandra and Mary have both said, we don't do that. We can't do that by pitting the interests of mothers against those of their unborn children. But what this means is that we can work together with people who don't share our pro-life, don't share our pro-life convictions. We can work with them. This victory makes it possible for us now to move into the democratic sphere and put together policies that will not only protect unborn babies, but also look after the interests of mothers who are so often in very, very difficult positions. Think of all the women who've been forced into abortion by what they regard as impossible circumstances, or by the pressures of boyfriends or parents or employers or so-called friends. We need to reach out to those women. We need to do the work legislatively and in the social and cultural domain, as Ryan rightly points out, we need to do the work that really will make us in every respect a pro-life society. So that was the point, Andrew, of my tweets. Let's look at this as an occasion to reach out our hand to people on the other side. We haven't changed their minds. We've just won a big victory. They have lost. But let's nevertheless reach out our hands and say, look, we recognize that your concerns are legitimate concerns, and we recognize that you sincerely have them, and we share them. We're pro-women too. So we want to work with you in ways that are consistent with respect for human life in all stages and conditions, work with you in ways that will benefit women across the board.
Great. Thanks, Robbie. Ryan, I want to turn to you, and just as a word to listeners, we will have a hard stop at no later than 1 p.m., so we are nearing the end of our Twitter space conversation. Ryan, you know, one of the principles of Scripture is showing honor to whom honor is due, and I've seen commendably so many people on social media discussing how, you know, there's not just one person responsible for today's victory. This is a 50-year-long march of people's blood, sweat, and tears, you know, tactically on the grounds, on serving vulnerable women and children. Just talk about the role of honor and no one claiming a single victory for this this moment that we're in.
So you're exactly right, Andrew. There are so many people who have labored for so long, for so many years, frequently without any limelight, without any attention, without seeking any limelight or attention to do their part to get us this moment. When we think about all the countless volunteers who have dedicated hours of their lives behind the scenes, working at pregnancy resource centers, think of the, you know, the quiet retirees who donate the widow's mite, right? Putting, you know, a sacrificial gift to help keep these pregnancy resource centers running, or donating to ADF and to other, you know, Americans United for Life, SBA list, other pro-life groups to get us to this point. But I want to, you know, mention, you know, some scholars in particular, people who deserve credit. It would be an injustice if Germaine Crozet and John Finnis did not get recognition for being some of the first pro-life scholars to make intellectually rigorous responding to all of the objections. There's a book by Grise that's like 500 or 600 pages long, back from the 70s, making the pro-life case. There's a just a hugely, you can't overstate the importance of an essay by John Finnis responding to Judith Jarvis Thomas that came out back in, I think, 1972. We stand on the shoulders of giants in this intellectual movement. And on our call, we have two of those people who I want to, you know, only slightly embarrass, but I think we can't overstate what Robbie George has done to get us to this moment, both on the constitutional law, explaining why Roe and Casey was wrong, but also on the moral philosophy. You know, Robbie has at least two, you know, critical pro-life books, one with Chris Tullison titled Embryo, one with Pat Lee titled Body Self Dualism, just making the moral argument for the dignity of the unborn child's life. A very famous essay titled The Wrong of Abortion. We can't overstate Robbie's role. The Solicitor General of Mississippi, the person who argued this case at the Supreme Court so effectively, a friend of mine from Princeton was a student of Robbie's at Princeton. So you can see the fingerprints there. And then other people think Leonard Leo, FedSoc, getting us these justices. But on this call, I can't think of anyone who has done more than Ed Whalen in getting five justices who voted in the majority, getting them across the finish line, getting them confirmed. And so I just think, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude both to Robbie and to Ed for getting us to this point.
Thanks so much, Ryan. All right, we're going to do a quick last thing before we conclude for today. And this is where I want every single one of our speakers, you have 30 seconds to explain the one thing that listeners should do in response to today's ruling. A call to action, so to speak. Dr. George, if you want to go first.
Well, there can be nothing more important than prayers of thanksgiving. I mean, ultimately, this victory is not ours, it's God's. And God has responded to our prayers in giving us this great decision. And so, first and above all, prayers of thanksgiving to God.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you for that. Sharif.
Well, I think that the bottom line is that this is, as many people have said, just the beginning. It's just taking away a roadblock to taking all of the steps that are needed at the practical level and at the legal level to make sure that women's needs are met and the children are protected.
Great. Thanks, Mary.
Yes, I would say look around you. For every one of us, there's someone in our circle, our church, our community who needs our help. And so I think that's an important call to action for today. Let's speak up. Let's open our eyes. Let's reach out and help those women and their babies who are in need. And I challenge corporations on that too. Instead of paying for people to travel to get an abortion, let's really reach out, open your eyes and reach out and help women and their babies.
Great. Ed?
Well, we've had 50 years in which there really hasn't been an opportunity to work to persuade our friends and neighbors and family members of the pro-life cause. Now is the time to do so, as Robbie has said, in a loving and generous way, but to make sure that we commit ourselves to advance justice and to engage people where they are and do our best to persuade them.
Great. Alexandra?
Yeah, I mean, many great things have been said. I would say just two things. The first is to pray for peace, you know, Thanksgiving certainly and celebrate, but for peace, I'm afraid of what violence might be coming. You know, I hope and pray that won't happen, but there are a lot of angry and hurting people out there who, and I'm afraid of how they might respond to this. So I think we certainly need to pray for the future of our country. And then secondly, just to kind of echo what others said, think about what you can do, right? Not everybody, none of us can do everything that needs to be done, but I think we all have at least one thing that we could do to contribute. Maybe it's, you know, finding out where the local pregnancy resource center is and volunteering or donating materials, donating financially. Maybe it's, you know, writing articles or whatever it is in your sphere of influence. Think of it as a call to action, right? We all have a responsibility. This is not a sit on the sidelines issue. It certainly wasn't before, but I think much less so now.
Great. Thanks, Alexandra. We're almost done here. And I just want to say thanks to the almost, I think, 700 people that joined us on this Twitter Spaces conversation. So our gratitude to you for spending almost an hour with us. As a reminder, this is an on the record conversation that is being recorded, and I will make available as soon as it is available. And if I can figure out how to post it, given my technological limitations at times. But with that, I'm going to give the final word to the president of the Ethics, not the Ethics and Legislative Commission, the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who is also the author of a forthcoming book with Alexandra DeSantis that comes out next week called Tearing Us Apart. So I don't want to get off the line without acknowledging that forthcoming volume. But Ryan, give us a last word, and then we will conclude.
Sure. First, thank you, Andrew, for hosting this. Thank you to Mary and Zan and Robbie and Ed and Carter and Sharif for speaking on this. I don't have anything new to say. I think everything has been said. I think it's been said very eloquently. And so I'll just echo two things. One, we should pray. We should pray for peace. We should pray for mothers experiencing difficult or unplanned pregnancies. We should pray for the policymakers who will be doing the work of passing legislation to assist mothers to form families, to come to the assistance of people in need, and to protect unborn children from lethal violence in the womb. And then each and every one of us should be praying to figure out what God's calling us to do to make a difference. And Zan said it very well, whether it's volunteering your time or donating your money to a pregnancy resource center, whether it's bearing witness to the truth, as Mary Hassan suggested, there's a role for all of us in our spheres of influence, given whatever our vocations are. We can't afford to have anyone sitting on the sidelines. There's a role for every one of us, given our gifts, given our talents, to bear witness to life and to build up a culture of life.
Great. Thank you so much. And again, I want to thank you for joining us. And I want to thank all of the EPPC scholars for spending an hour of their time to walk through this most significant and historic day. And with that, we will conclude, and I'll post this when it's available. Thank you so much and have a great day.